how Liberty dies. With thunderous applause.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host Scott with Uncle Ian. Today's matchup is Henry VIII against Oliver Cromwell. Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause is a history podcast obsessed with history's greatest dictators. We have created a knockout competition to determine the single most significant dictator of all time. Each episode features a matchup of two dictators where we discuss the life and times of each leader. The loser of each battle is eliminated from the tournament. The winner remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. Today we have a special guest, Stephanie, who will be helping us run through Henry VIII.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Stephanie, please tell us about Henry VIII.
Thank you. Henry VIII, an English monarch. He was born in the 15th century in 1491. Henry was the second son of Henry VII, who was the founder of the Tudor dynasty, and also his mother Elizabeth of York. Henry ascended the throne in 1509 at the age of 17, and he was king for about 38 years until his death at age 56. As a dictator, although Henry ruled as a king by hereditary descent, the power that he possessed and wielded was essentially beyond any constitutional limits, and he would change the system throughout his reign to suit his purposes at any given time. He often ruled his kingdom by means of intimidation, fear, and the general suppression of civil liberties. Henry executed more people than any other British monarch in history, and during his reign it's estimated that he killed between 57,000 and 72,000 English subjects.
Oh, that's great stuff.
Yeah, it's a lot of people.
If anyone tries to write in and say, this guy is a monarch, he's not a dictator, I refer you to what Steph just said.
It's a little known fact. He also had very interesting ways of killing people. The first thing that comes to mind with Henry is lots of beheadings, and would say most people know that he beheaded a few of his wives. There was quite a range of killings going on in his kingdom at the time. A few modes of torture. There was pressing, which is very similar to, I think it was Ivan the Terrible that you spoke about a few episodes ago, where you would put a board on top of people and slowly add weight and crush them until they couldn't breathe. Lots of boiling alive. And it would depend, you know, there might be oil, water, some other kind of substance, and he would strap the people up above a cauldron and dip them in and take them out and dip them in and take them out until they slowly died to draw out the torture. Another popular one was being hanged, drawn, and quartered, which is exactly what it sounds like. No fun for high treason. Lots of burning at the stake, particularly for people who in his early reign wouldn't acknowledge Catholic religion. Women who killed their husbands and servants who killed their masters, not a good way to go. He also invented during his time a number of torture instruments. There was a scavenger's daughter, which is like an A-frame iron brace, quite small. It would require you sitting in a crouched position, hunched over your knees, and the bar above you was like slowly tightened, which would crush you and kill you.
Oh.
Yeah. These are some of the lesser known ways that he killed people, but quite significant and quite prominent throughout the reign all the same. Aside from all of the killings, Henry is quite well known for the religious and political changes that he brought about during his time, which was something that was quite unprecedented in that stage of history. Henry instigated the separation of England from the Roman Catholic state, set up his own religion in England, being the Church of England. It had a flow-on effect that is still significant today, in effect, not just England, but many countries throughout the world. And a lot of that was purely to fuel whatever personal ambition he had at the time, or twist things to suit his own goals. And religion in particular became a weapon that was one of his most recognizable dictatorial behaviors, even if it's not immediately seen as such, which I think is just fascinating.
Yes, it's interesting to think that this man had ultimate power, and the only area that he didn't have absolute authority was in matters of religion. Mm. And then not long into his reign, he decides, you know what? I'm going to start my own religion so that I can be the head of the Church of England. That way, there's no aspect of public life over which he doesn't have complete control.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
When Henry VIII took over, became king, it followed a very tumultuous time for England. More evidence that he was a dictator consolidating his power was that his ascension to the throne was the first time in 100 years that a adult heir was crowned, because prior to that, it was a lot of children inheriting the throne, or a usurper replacing a usurper. This tumultuous time encourages Henry to be more dictatorial and really consolidate his power.
Definitely. And I mean, he was never meant to be king. Being the second son, his older brother Arthur was intended to be king, meant to be king, trained to be king. Henry was having a lovely childhood until he was about 10 years old when Arthur died of the sweating sickness. Had just married Catherine of Aragon. They were married for about 20 days. And here comes the controversy, whether they consummated their marriage or not. Sources say that they didn't. Henry would later say that they did.
And after 20 days? That's a poor
20
effort.
20 days. Remember, he's very sick. You know, oh, he's got corona. He's in bed.
Yeah.
He's okay. Not well.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
he wasn't wearing the appropriate face mask.
No.
No. Poor thing.
So Arthur died in 1502. And then what happens to Catherine after the death of Arthur?
For a time, Catherine was Princess Dowager because she had been married to Arthur. But Henry VIII, father, was still quite keen on arranging a political alliance between England and Spain, where Catherine was from. It was discussed that they would continue on, solidify this relationship by engaging Catherine to Henry, who was now first in line for the throne. Made sense. It was a bit of an issue at the time, obviously, because the religious connotations behind marrying your brother's ex-wife was a bit of a problem. If someone is married at the time, they're taken to be married. We assume that it's been consummated. And then that person becomes, for Henry, your sister. Then there's incestuous connotations. There's you must not lay with your brother's wife. There's a whole slew of issues. And this all comes from Leviticus in the Bible. So the Roman Catholic Church was very against it at the time. They had to seek out special papal dispensation in order to allow the marriage to go forward and say that Arthur and Catherine's marriage was not consummated. And so it wasn't a real marriage. She was able to then go on and marry Henry when they were young.
She gets shafted for a period when there's a falling out between England and Spain and the engagement to Henry VIII is called off. And she's
stuck in England for a while.
Yeah, and the Henry VII, Henry's father, can't send her back to Spain because he's already spent all her dowry money. So she's stuck there. She becomes very upset. She writes a letter to her father, the King of Spain, saying, I want to come home or I want to become a nun and I'll kill myself unless I'm able to become a nun. And the King of Spain kind of just ignores that. Eventually, England and Spain patch up their differences and she's engaged again to Henry VIII.
Did not suit their plan at all to have her become a nun or kill herself. There are some sources and there's historical fiction that say Henry VII kind of liked the idea of having her around because he sort of fancied her as his next wife.
Yeah, that's a bit creepy.
Yeah, apparently he was quite flirty with her.
Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, when do they get married?
They get married. Henry was 17, Catherine was 23.
And interestingly, didn't get married until after Henry VII had died, which lends source to that possibility that Henry VII didn't want Catherine marrying Henry his son.
And Henry VII dies in 1509, and then Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon have a joint coronation.
Sources say that they were quite enamoured with each other, or at least Henry was enamoured with Catherine.
And then they encounter some problems.
Yes. So the biggest issue was the line of succession. Henry, obviously, as you mentioned before, Scott, really wanted to secure the succession, really wanted to secure his dynasty, make sure that he had a solid basis for his reign. They had a bit of trouble. They had a lot of stillbirth children, few miscarriages. They only had one living daughter, Mary, but as the years progressed, they were just unsuccessful in producing a second heir. But they were married for 18 years. They were married before Henry decided that Catherine's time was up, and eventually he proclaimed that all of the stillbirths and their miscarriages were evidence of them living in mortal sin, and that getting that papal dispensation at the beginning of their marriage so that he could marry his brother's wife was wrong and they should never have done that. So he hung his hat on that religious reason as a basis for moving forward and trying to get an annulment from Catherine originally. And at this point, she's about 40 years old, which is past prime childbearing years in any age. He realised that they were sort of at the end of their tether in terms of securing the line of succession between the two of them.
Henry VIII had a bastard son with his mistress, it proves to him that he can have a son, and maybe it's either the fault of Catherine or God's will that they don't have a son together.
Yes, and whether he had other bastard children, it's been unconfirmed, but...
Likely.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Mm. And Catherine had multiple miscarriages. At one point, she has a miscarriage, and the doctor tells her, oh no, don't worry, you were carrying twins, and you've miscarried the girl, but you're still pregnant with the boy. And then months go by, and they slowly realise, I think this doctor's wrong, because this baby boy is not coming.
I can only imagine the stress that she would have been under at the time. Oh, the evil May Day riots in 1517. The people in London were getting very upset about the amount of foreigners in the city. Poor English people didn't have anywhere to go.
Hence Brexit.
The word came to Henry that there were going to be attacks on all of the foreigners and that they were going to be killed and robbed and all of these sorts of horrible things. So Henry promised all of the foreigners protection. And it was posted up publicly, don't do this, don't do that, you will suffer consequences. There was a curfew put in place. Despite this, on May Day 1517, all of these Londoners went out with weapons and were attacking all the foreigners. They sacked something like 2,000 houses. The official statement that came out from Henry's government afterwards was that women were to blame, because if we didn't allow women to stand around blabbering and blithering to each other in the market, then none of this discontent would have arisen.
That's so good. That's good logic.
That's good logic. He rounds the rioters up in two goes. So 279 rioters are rounded up initially, including like lots of young boys who are getting involved in it. They all think that they're going there to be chastised. Again, changes his mind, hanged, drawn and quartered. All of these young kids, the brutality and the severity of this repression when nobody was killed was not accepted by the London people. It went very poorly for Henry. And then in the second wave of rioters that were being rounded up, they came in. He brought them in with nooses around their necks, ready to go, sat them all there. They had a good cry. He condemned them all to death. And then Wolsey and possibly Catherine of Aragon, who was his wife at the time, begged for mercy, crying, saying it was awful and that, you know, the people wouldn't forgive him. He thought about it for a little while and set them free. He really needed to mend his public image at that point.
How do we get from Catherine to his next wife?
Henry's upset. He thinks he's living in sin. At least that's what he tells the public. And he's a very religious guy. He attends mass three times a day, always has. He's always been very involved in the church, so it's not that much of a shock that he would have these thoughts. It just seems a little bit convenient. He's already become enamored with this paramour Anne Boleyn off to the side, who is one of the ladies in waiting. He then approaches Pope Clement VII with what's now known as the King's Great Matter, trying to reverse the earlier papal power, which allowed him to marry Catherine, get an annulment, and then go on to marry somebody else so that he could move on and secure this line of succession. But Pope Clement wasn't really willing to do this. I think the whole reversal of an earlier power didn't sit well with him. He also had very close ties to Spain and the Holy Roman Emperor Charles, who was Catherine's nephew, so it wasn't very well received. This is really what kicked off one of his most well-known acts as king, in stepping outside the established boxes and starting the English Reformation. Essentially, what Henry did was say, we're not going to acknowledge the Roman Catholic Church as the ultimate seat of religious power anymore. England's going to completely separate itself. I, as king, am going to be God's representative on earth, and I'm going to start the Church of England, which really moves the religion into the state itself, separates them completely from Rome, and starts a whole new system. By doing this, Henry was then able to set his own rules and say, marriage is not okay, I've told you why, divorce his wife Catherine, then marry Anne Boleyn in a secret wedding service, which was later followed by a formal wedding, but that sort of gives away a little bit that, you know, he's trying to get around everything quite quickly. And this kicks off a huge stream of political changes within England. The Session Act, the Supremacy Act, and there's to acknowledge Henry as head of the church and God's representative. There's the Act of Restraint of Appeals, which abolishes the right of appeal to Rome. And there's the Treasons Act, which makes it a capital offence to speak about the king's death at all. And by that point, the Roman Catholic Church has kind of had enough of him, so Henry is excommunicated. Although it's interesting that even though he goes through this reformation, Henry's base, his fundamental religious view, doesn't really change at all. He has the same beliefs. He's still quite religious. There are certain things about the Church of England that are different to the original Roman Catholic Church. There's the consubstantiation, transubstantiation debate, which is, you know, when you're taking the host, the body of Christ, the blood of Christ, is it actually transformed into the body of Christ, or is it a metaphor? The Bible was translated into English, which is something that he started and was adapted over time into what is now the Common Book of Prayer and the King James Bible. Things that he originally started and words that he put in, till death do us part, from the marriage liturgy, that started with him. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, also started with Henry. In the whole process, Henry was involved quite heavily in the purging of the church and the purging of the monasteries as well. So there was a lot of sacking of monasteries. As an aside, Henry was a very flamboyant king. He loved putting on huge parties and dancing, and he spent something like $18 million on a Christmas party by modern times. It just insane amounts of money he was spending. He inherited $424 million from his father, and by the end of his reign, he was virtually bankrupt. So during his split, during the Reformation, he goes ahead and sacks the monasteries. They're all corrupt. They're doing the wrong thing, so he says. And he claims all of this money from the monasteries for himself. And it goes straight into the royal purse, which is quite neat for him. He also takes all of their monasteries, all of their property, their castles, anything like that. So suddenly, he, you know, gets what he wants. He gets a divorce. He sets up his own church. He's supreme ruler. He's set up treason if anyone speaks against him. And so he's in a fantastic position by just doing this one thing. It isn't just about separating from his wife. He's really achieved a lot in this one strategic move.
And yet, Anne is unable to give him what he really wants.
Yes. For all of his efforts, Anne also fails to give Henry a son. She does give him a daughter, who will be Elizabeth I. The marriage is relatively short-lived. They're only married for about 4 years. And it was quite a difficult marriage. There was a lot of bickering, a lot of fighting. He didn't like Anne's temper. I'm sure she didn't like his either. About 4 years in, Henry accuses Anne of conspiracy, adultery, witchcraft, incest. He goes full flu, takes on Jane Seymour as a mistress, and has Anne arrested for treasonable adultery and incest with her brother. She is then convicted and condemned to death. This is the first time that Henry executes his wife by beheading at the Tower of London. And that too is an unprecedented. That was a real step forward and a show of his brutality.
One act of kindness he bestows upon Anne Boleyn is that he ships over a French swordsman to behead her, so he would be nice and clean and quick, which is kind, I guess.
Yes, but you do have to wonder, how did the swordsman get there in time for the accusal and beheading? That person had to have been ordered far in advance to get there.
Oh, very suspicious.
Especially with 14 days quarantine.
Anne has a miscarriage, obviously prior to her death. She miscarries what could have been their son and heir. Mm. Henry's very severely injured in a jousting accident. He loves his sport, loves jousting.
Mm-hmm. Very proud of his powerful calves.
He loves his calves, thinks his calves are the best. And yet, he has this accident while jousting and injures his leg. And not the calves, everyone screamed. And that really exacerbates his varicose ulcers. It disables him for the rest of his life. And the image we have of Henry VIII is this morbidly obese monarch, and that is a result of the disability from this accident where he couldn't exercise because he was very sporty. And then when he dies, he's estimated at weighing 174 kilos. So he's a big bopper. He was so fat they created some sort of device to carry him upstairs. Like, it was like on a pulley system.
Yeah, it was like a crane.
Which is good technology, but it's just this big lump of a human. He's carried around. He can't even walk around his own palace.
And he was like that in that last war as well. He led the troops into battle, but he led them into battle on one of those litters, like a bed that's carried, which isn't exactly a rousing sight for the troops. And he's a towering guy too. He was over 6 foot tall, which is a giant for the time. He's gone from being this huge athletic guy who apparently is quite charming, speaks different languages, is very healing, and then suddenly he's this huge, fat, smelly, irritable guy who's killing his wives and cutting everybody down.
You mentioned smelly. Apparently he could smell him from 3 rooms away because of those festering ulcers.
Medicine being what it was, they kept cutting them open and sort of trying to let them weep, because they thought that if the ulcers wept out the toxins, then they would get better, but they really just needed to let them heal.
Oh, that's terrible.
So they didn't help him at all. He just got progressively worse. They said he was eating 13 full meals a day and drinking 10 litres of mead or
something. Yeah, that sounds good.
He was very depressed.
So Henry's probably fortunate in some respects that our image of him comes from the Holbein portrait.
Yes.
None of which make reference to any sort of pesky skin diseases or any sort of obesity. It just makes him look like a real colossus, not only ruling over England, but being big enough and strong enough and manly enough to take on the Pope and emerge victorious.
And we're lucky that portraits don't convey smell.
Yes, we are. But they do convey powerful calves.
Yeah. Anne Boleyn dies, and then he moves on to Jane Seymour, his mistress.
He does. And reportedly, his true love, Jane Seymour. Henry is to this day buried with Jane Seymour, his third wife. Jane Seymour, as Henry's third wife, they were married shortly after Anne's execution, the day after, in fact. And shortly after that, Jane Seymour bore Henry's one and only son, Edward. Finally, a son for the succession. But tragically, Jane died in childbirth, which hit Henry very hard. And as Scott mentioned, Henry's now at the stage of his life where he's sick, he's injured, he's getting fatter, he's upset, he's been excommunicated, and he's been at war for years. So suddenly he's in this horrible dark spiral and goes into quite a serious depression after Jane's death. And a lot of that contributes to his ill temper and the way that he carries on his reign. Oh,
yep,
I have a fun fact.
Yeah, that's good.
Right towards the end of his reign, when he was really fat and ugly and all that sort of thing, got really paranoid and stressed about people trying to kill him. Fun rumours flew around that he would go into his bed chamber and each night he would ask his people to brick him in so that no one could get into his bedchamber, and then they'd unbrick him in the morning. So he was completely locked off.
What if he needs to go to the toilet?
I think he had an ensuite.
Yeah. No, yeah, good yeah. decision.
And you know, he had a groom of the stool who was a knight whose job was to sleep by his bed, change his underwear on him, and wipe his bottom, essentially. Yeah, very, very privileged position, ironically, because, you know, you're so close to the king all the time. It's very intimate. People looked up to you.
And then he moves on to Anne of Cleves.
Anne of Cleves, yes. Shortly afterwards, a marriage that was set up by Thomas Cromwell, not to be confused with Oliver Cromwell, who we'll speak about later. Anne of Cleves came over from Germany, but Henry hadn't seen Anne before they got married. He had somebody go over, paint a portrait of Anne, send it back. He looked and thought, yes, she'll do quite fine. By the time Anne got over, Henry was shocked and said that she looked like a fat breeding mare. With a face like a horse. He wasn't interested at all. Absolutely horrified at this match that he'd been stuck with.
So he was ditched up by a flattering portrait.
Yes.
Oh, we've all been there, mate.
Tinder profiles.
That's so good.
So that marriage didn't last very long at all.
That one's annulled. They're both very happy. She agrees to the annulment and probably thinking, oh, I better agree, otherwise I might get beheaded.
Yeah, she dodged a bullet there. Dodged an axe. But she stays in England for pretty much the rest of his life, and she's called the king's sister, and they have a great relationship. They become friends.
And then we have Catherine Howard. This is wife number 5 for everyone keeping track. So we've gone from Catherine to Anne to Jane to another Anne to another Catherine. Catherine Howard, who he marries in July 28, 1540, which is the same day that the aforementioned Thomas Cromwell is executed. She's Anne Boleyn's first cousin.
She is, yes.
And she was only 17, and she was a little bit promiscuous, it seems.
Yes. Apparently, she was engaged to a prior suitor before she was formally married to Henry, which becomes a real problem for him later on. So when she ends up mucking around with all of these other people during their marriage, during their short marriage, Henry doesn't take it very well. Doesn't take it very well at all. Biggest, blackest stain against Catherine's name becomes that she's a notorious adulterer. Henry sentences her to treason and adultery, and she becomes the second of Henry's wives to be beheaded by Henry. And it's said that when she was 19 and on the way to the scaffold, she was running down the halls of Hampton Court screaming for mercy, hoping Henry would give her clemency. which he didn't. And they say to this day, her ghost still haunts that corridor and people have heard screams throughout the years.
What's the story with Hampton Court, with the advisor Cardinal Wolsey?
Cardinal Wolsey, for our listeners who don't know, was a hugely influential advisor of Henry during his early reign, helped with the sacking of the monasteries, the cleansing of the church, assisted him with his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. Wolsey started to lose favour a little bit towards the end of Henry's marriage with Catherine of Aragon and when he started to be interested in Anne Boleyn. And he was building this great, beautiful palace at the time, just to be Wolsey's own residence, this grand residence where he could host the king and host all these big parties. And it was going to be really grand for him to have this magnificent palace. So one day Wolsey takes the king to see this fantastic, beautiful palace that he's built. And the king, you know, looks at it, weighs it up and thinks, "Oh, that is a palace fit for a king. Very nice. I like it." And then Wolsey checks himself for a moment and thinks, "Oh dear." And Henry says, "I think I'll just take that palace for myself." Takes this beautiful palace Wolsey's been building for years, which is Hampton Court, and it's still the royal seat of the royal family to this day.
Oh, that's so good. Poor Wolsey.
Poor Wolsey. Oh, it's not a good run for him.
No. And so Henry moves on to Catherine number three, wife number six, Catherine Parr.
Yes, Catherine Parr. Catherine Parr. So this is Henry's sixth marriage. It's also Catherine Parr's fourth marriage. She's quite a wealthy widow herself at this time.
They both got formed by this stage.
Yes, I know. Remember, Henry's not in a good way physically, mentally at this time of his life. So it's said that Catherine spent most of her time sort of caring for him in his ill health and old age. And they seemed to lead a fairly happily married life. She reunited him with his daughters who, throughout the years, he's been dropping in and out of the line of succession, vanishing, sending off, and all this sort of thing. So she did a lot of good, I suppose, for him in his later time. And she is the only one who survived Henry. She outlived him, aside from killing, you know, a few of his wives. He also killed anyone that was kind of associated with them. And he killed anybody who was a competition to the throne. Like, he decimated the Courtenay family and the de la Pole family. Margaret de la Pole was one of the, we think, maybe the oldest person to be held in the Tower of London and then executed by Henry. She was 67 years old and she'd been living in the Tower for years because she was related to the previous royal family and he was worried there might be competition or conspiracies against him. He was very paranoid. 67, sentenced to death. They dragged her down to the Tower Green. She was kicking and screaming, tried to escape and run away, and then they pulled her back, pinned her down, and she was squirming so much. Apparently it took the executioner 11 goes to get her head off.
That is gross.
It's not good. This old woman having a terrible time.
It's just a really thick, strong neck.
Apparently that's the way Cromwell went too. All those sources are divided on that. Yeah, wars. If you talk about the wars, in my opinion, the wars aren't so significant in terms of long-term effect that Henry had, but as a dictator, it really shows the way that he perceives things. And I mentioned before that he had all of this money at the start of his reign, and he essentially bankrupts himself trying to go to war with France and then Spain and then France and then Spain and then try and conquer Scotland and then go against France again. And it was extremely unpopular with the council. One of his advisors, Thomas More, kept telling him that the wisdom would be to leave them alone. And he didn't really have any significant military achievements. He essentially achieved nothing with his military exploits except killing a bunch of people. He also failed to progress his military in any significant sense. What he did do, though, was organize the English fleet, and he expanded the navy from 5 ships to 53 ships during his reign. So he's often called the father of the Royal Navy. He established the Navy Board. England became a real power on the seas again. despite being unsuccessful in battle.
Along with the Reformation, greatest legacy, the British Empire, the largest ever empire assembled, is down to him and the expansion of the navy.
Yes.
The rough wooing of Scotland is far more brutal than innocent little name suggests. In 1543, before the War of France, he doesn't want to fight a war on two fronts because the last time he invaded France, Scotland invaded England. So he decides, I'll invade Scotland first. And he defeats the Scots at the Battle of the Solway Moss, and that gives himself a free hand in France. And King James V dies in that battle. Mary becomes queen, who is known as Mary, Queen of Scots. And she's born 6 days prior to this battle. And so Henry decides, I'm going to unite the crowns of England and Scotland. He wants to marry his son Edward to Mary, and Scottish Parliament rejects it. And they say, if your lad was a lass and our lass was a lad, would you allow this to happen? Knowing that the king will have ultimate power and the queen will be relegated. So this begins an 8-year campaign to subdue Scotland, which is called the Rough Wooing of Scotland, because it's all about forcing them to submit to English rule through the marriage to Mary. Henry's armies absolutely obliterate Edinburgh. The only thing that survives is Edinburgh Castle. The rest of it is completely burned down. But he was unsuccessful. Mary, Queen of Scots, does not marry Prince Edward.
Do you want to know about other fun facts?
Definitely.
Okay. Fun fact. Henry VIII passed the Buggery Act in 1533, homosexuality a criminal offence, and it was the first act that was like this in England and one of the first in any Germanic country. And that act persisted well into the 19th century. I think the last two people who were executed under this act, it was 1835. So unjust executions based on something that he did for centuries after his death. Big impact.
Yes, and he also banned sodomy.
Yes, that was part of that act.
All those sodomites out there are not very happy about that.
No, and he said, you know, it's against homosexuality, but it's also against sodomy, and it's also against intercourse with animals.
That's fair enough. The banning of sex with animals, I'm on board with that.
I feel like that's probably...
Other fun fact,
there was, in 1536, the same year that he fell off his horse jousting, there was this big pilgrimage called the Pilgrimage of Grace, where a number of people were rebelling against the change in religion in the country. Huge revolution. And they all came from, I think it was from the north. Henry said, stop, let's talk about it. Thanks so much for your comments. Really appreciate your feedback on what I've done. And he spoke to the guy leading it. One of them was Robert Ask. And they said, oh, fantastic. We'll have a good chat about this and we'll find a way forward. Then they send all of the supporting people home. They say, it's great. We're going to talk to the king. It's going to be sorted. And then Henry's like, fantastic. Now that their army has been disbanded, we're going to kill you all. So he kills all of the leaders. Ask himself is hanged, drawn, and quartered. That's something that forms a pattern with Henry. He always promises clemency. He says that he's changing his mind. He's going to be merciful. And then he turns around and kills people.
That's fantastic stuff.
Very dictatorial.
Yeah. He's like, oh, we're going to have a good chat about it. You know, send your army away. We'll just have a bit of a chat. Come into my execution area and just put your head right here.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
That's so good.
Real guy. I mean, he allegedly, he did this with Anne Boleyn as well, going to offer you mercy. Didn't, obviously. Catherine Howard, going to offer you mercy, didn't. It was quite common for him to do this, say that he was going to give clemency and then take it back at the last minute. And often he wouldn't tell the people. He would just have somebody show up at the house and be like, you're going to be murdered today.
He just doesn't want to have that awkward breakup conversation. So he's like, I love you, honey.
That's exactly what it was like, yes. He had Richard Roos boiled alive because Roos put what he said was a laxative in Bishop Fisher, who was one of Henry's advisors, put a laxative in Bishop Fisher's meal, which they then gave some of it to the poor, and a bunch of people died because it was poison. So he was hung over boiling liquid, you know, lowered rose, killed slowly over time. He maintained it was a joke. I'm not sure about that.
How much food is this bloke eating that whole meal can be distributed to the poor?
Yes, a lot, apparently.
So Henry VIII dies on 28th of January 1547, and his son Edward becomes king. And as you said, he's buried with his third wife, Jane Seymour, who he always considered his real wife. And how's this stuff? For his burial, they take parts of Cardinal Wolsey's tomb to bury him with, because he's just not done stealing from Cardinal Wolsey.
He's just, you know, maybe it's a compliment. He thinks so highly of Wolsey's architectural and design techniques.
Edward becomes king, dies, doesn't have any kids, so Henry's first daughter Mary becomes queen. She's known as Bloody Mary because she's Catholic and tries to revert the whole country back to Catholicism. She dies, and then Elizabeth comes in, Henry's second daughter, and she reverts the country back to the Church of England, and the Elizabethan era is born. You get Shakespeare and the Age of Exploration. And she doesn't have any kids, and despite the Stuarts being effectively banned in Henry's will of becoming monarchs of England, there's no one left. So the Scottish Stuarts, who are related to Henry,
his sister's kids,
James becomes
first of England.
The Tudor line is ended and the Stuart line begins. Uncle Ian, you ready? It's time to introduce our second dictator in this matchup, Oliver Cromwell. Uncle Ian, please tell us about Oliver Cromwell.
Oliver Cromwell, we've heard the name Cromwell already today. Oliver was the great-great-nephew of Thomas Cromwell, one of Henry's ministers. Oliver was born in 1599, and we don't know much about his early life. It was a reasonably comfortable life, because at one stage he was able to attend Cambridge. We do know that he got married in 1620, and we know that he was elected to Parliament in 1628. It was a short-lived parliamentary career, because in 1629 the King dissolved Parliament and undertook a personal monarchy which went for a period of 11 years. So that King was Charles. He was the son of James the First of England, who inherited the throne from Elizabeth. During the time of Charles's personal monarchy, Oliver Cromwell returned to the family farm, such as it was. He's called a yeoman farmer. Best definition of that is that he had to do some of the work himself. So it certainly wasn't a privileged life at that stage, although one of his uncles passed away and left him some estates, so he was able to change his business card from being a yeoman farmer to a gentleman farmer. And in 1640, Charles wanted to go to war with Scotland, so he needed to raise some taxes, so he needed to recall Parliament, and Cromwell resumed his seat in Parliament. We're not really in a position to go through the ins and outs of the Civil War, just a few key components of the English Civil War, which commenced in 1642. At its base, it was Parliament versus the Royalists. Cromwell was very much parliamentary, and he became a military leader of the Parliamentary Army, which was also known as the Roundheads, against the Royalists, who were also known as the Cavaliers.
Uncle, do you know the origin of the term Roundhead?
I think it's literally how they cut their hair.
Oh, because they've got so that weird, ugly Puritan haircut.
Yes. It wasn't a complimentary term by any means, okay, but it stuck. Now, Cromwell had no military experience, but he was a fast learner in the leadership of cavalry, and that led him to very high position in what was called the New Model Army. That was formed in 1645 by the Parliament. Cromwell proved himself to be expert in cavalry strategy, logistics and supplies, focused a lot of attention on the morale of the troops, made sure they got paid regularly, made sure that they were promoted on the basis of merit rather than just being put into roles because of their social standing. This was a Protestant army. They were very religious, and one of the quotes about the New Model Army is that they marched with a pike, so it's a type of spear, with a pike in one hand and a Bible in the other. In June in 1645 was the Battle of Naseby. That was followed by the surrender of the Royalist Army. In 1647, there were unsuccessful negotiations with Charles. That led to the Civil War restarting in 1648. And Cromwell's letters at the time show that he believed that he and his army had been chosen by God to restore God to his proper position in English life, without the king as a component of that. Charles was captured, put on trial. History has recorded it as being very much a show trial. Cromwell's on record as saying that they were going to chop his head off, even if the crown was still on it. That eventually happened in January of 1649, when Charles was executed. Cromwell's signature was the third on the death warrant. Interestingly, the parliamentary forces continued to obtain signatures on the death warrant after the execution had been carried out in order to try and share the responsibility killing the king.
It's such a significant event. No king has been killed publicly with the show trial. I mean, kings have been killed previously in English history, but usually by other monarchs with a claim to the throne. And now you have Parliament killing the king and executing him in public, and the people of England are shocked.
It did come as a shock, not just to the people of England, but to the people of Europe, because at that stage there was still the belief in the divine right of kings, that God had chosen kings to rule. It's only 60-odd years since Mary, Queen of Scots, had been executed, but that was on the order of another monarch, so it's a different style of category. In England, they were very happy to have a commonwealth. It was different in the other parts of the realm. While the same person was the King of Scotland and the King of England, they were still two separate crowns. So Scotland immediately proclaimed a new king, who happened to be Charles's son, also named Charles. So we had a Charles II as King of Scotland and a commonwealth in England to be ruled by Parliament and a council of state. The Irish also had a strong royalist feeling at the time, and so Cromwell, in his capacity as a successful general, led the invasion of Ireland in 1649-1650.
How did that turn out for the Irish?
Not well. Cromwell had a very strong mindset, a very strong anti-Catholic mindset, and didn't seem to care what the consequences were of the invasion. So there were a number of battles, and a number of them were followed by massacres. So at Drogheda, for example, on the Irish east coast, there was murders which had been calculated at least around the 3,000 mark, but quite possibly more, and that was replicated in other parts of Ireland as well. Catholicism was banned, priests were captured, locked in their churches, and then the churches were burnt. And even in Drogheda today, there's still a street called Scarlet Street, so named for all the blood that flowed down as a result of the invasion, which was led by Cromwell. Even to this day, Cromwell is still a dirty word in Ireland.
After the wars in Ireland, 40% of the population had died.
Yeah, the proportion of casualties as a result of this invasion was a higher proportion than the Irish who died from the potato famine. It was also a higher proportion than the number of Russians who died in the Second World War. Mind-boggling, the level of devastation. The next task for Cromwell on behalf of Parliament was to take care of the Scots. Again, a common theme in English history. The Scottish army to assert their right to choose their own king or to have a monarchy in place. There were battles at Dunbar. The Scottish got as far south as Worcester, but at that point they were annihilated by Cromwell's highly trained, highly motivated army. Charles II went into exile on the continent. The English Parliament was purged of the Royalists, and that became the Parliament known as the Rump Parliament, which Cromwell and his fellow commanders could pretty much rely on for their support.
The invasion of Ireland and Scotland and the absolute domination of those two countries by Cromwell is astonishing. Ireland has been a thorn in England's side forever, and they've never been able to fully absorb it. And then the Scots, they've never been able to fully take Scotland. The Romans couldn't conquer Scotland. The Normans couldn't conquer Scotland. No English monarch could conquer Scotland. And then Cromwell does it in a year.
Yep. Oh, from a military standpoint, to have conquered Ireland and Scotland was a tremendous achievement. And you're right, it was unprecedented in terms of leadership in Britain. Interestingly, once he'd conquered Ireland and conquered Scotland, they were still trying to sort out how to rule England. The Parliament had a couple of goes at setting up a council of state. Interestingly, by the end of 1653, Parliament had determined that they couldn't manage to rule without a single leader. So even though they put the king on trial and executed him, they still went back to a monarchical model. In December of 1653, as much as a reflection of his prestige as a successful general, Parliament asked Cromwell to become Lord Protector for life. He accepted that and became the supreme ruler of England. There was still a constitution in place, which did set up that there had to be a Parliament, but in reality, Cromwell had supreme power.
It's like a president for life situation.
The beautiful thing from Cromwell's perspective, though, is that he had been asked to take on the role. He didn't have to set up a coup or hold a dodgy election. He was asked to take on the Lord Protector role.
He was even offered the crown.
Yes. Yes, he was, and he was tempted to take on the crown, but the army leaders convinced him to reject becoming king. Echoes of Julius Caesar there. He'd previously undertaken administrative reform, dividing England into a series of regions, each of which had one of his major generals as a military governor. This became very unpopular, firstly because they implemented and collected taxes locally, and secondly, because they were the implementers of the Puritan regime. So while Cromwell didn't have a secret police, he did have a set of fun police. The Puritans didn't like people enjoying themselves, basically.
They banned all entertainment.
They did ban all entertainment. There were fines for swearing. The theatre was banned. And remember, this was not that long after Shakespeare and Bacon, so there was plenty of theatre going around. They banned horse racing and they banned Christmas.
Oh.
Christmas was seen as very Catholic. So they banned Christmas. So no wonder they were unpopular.
You can't be doing that. Unpopular. You can't be banning Christmas. So you can't go to the theatre. You can't celebrate Christmas. Henry's already banned sodomy.
There's not much left to do except stay home and do your needlepoint, really.
Yes.
In the middle of all of this, he did have a reputation for religious tolerance, as long as you weren't Catholic. So, for example, he overturned the expulsion of the Jews. That went back to the 1290s under Edward I. Cromwell overturned that and welcomed Jews back as one of his ways of expanding trade and expanding commerce.
I love the idea of religious toleration for everybody but the Catholics.
Yes.
It's like, there's two things I hate, racists and black people.
Exactly. He reinforced that English was to be the official language, underlining what Henry had brought into place, and after a short war with the Dutch, signed a treaty and actually commenced a strong trading relationship with the Dutch. And this was part of opening up the English economy by trading with people who weren't Catholic. So, Scott, you mentioned before that he was offered the crown, and he decided that he couldn't take the name of king. However, got very close to it. I'm quoting from David Starkey's book, Crown and Country. Cromwell was reinvested as Lord Protector. So he'd first taken on the role in 1653. By 1657, he wanted to assert his authority. So Starkey writes, Cromwell's second inauguration as Protector took place on the 26th of June, 1657, in Westminster Hall. The first had been modest. This was virtually regal. Edward's coronation chair was brought from Westminster Abbey. Cromwell was invested with an imperial robe of purple velvet lined with ermine. He was presented with a gilt-bound and embossed Bible, a golden-hilted sword, and a massive solid gold scepter. He swore a version of the coronation oath, and finally, seated in the coronation chair, he was acclaimed three times to the sound of trumpets and the cry, God save the Lord Protector. All that was missing was the crown itself, and that appeared on his coinage and great seal. Oliver was now indeed king in all but name. Cromwell had rid Britain of its king, but as Lord Protector, he now held more power than any king of England had ever held. End of quote. So, it was all about the name. He wouldn't take the name king, but in practical terms was king. He even asked to be addressed as Your Highness, and despite the fact that we've spoken about the fun police, he still liked hunting. Apparently he was fond of opera as well, so there were private operas performed for him, which is a bit hypocritical given that he banned the theatre. He also sought and obtained the right to nominate his own successor. He's pretty much doing everything out of the monarch textbook except being called king. He also continued the expansion of the British Empire. We mentioned the navy established under the reign of Henry VIII. And of course, by the mid-17th century, the colonies in America were a great source of income for Britain. And this was an opportunity to go to war with a Catholic country. So under Cromwell's rule, recommencement of what probably seemed like a never-ending war with Spain, but this time over the colonies in the Caribbean and in the southern part of what we now know as the USA.
The wars with Spain in the Caribbean led to the English ownership of Jamaica, which is why Jamaica was an English colony and speaks English, and you get those fantastic accents.
Yes. Yeah, if you look at the map of the Caribbean, there were at various times English, Spanish, French, and Dutch colonies. Once Columbus had accidentally discovered the Caribbean islands, it became a bit of a free-for-all for setting up colonies and starting plantations, be it sugar or tobacco. So that war was in place in the latter part of Cromwell's rule. He became ill, and in September 1658, Oliver Cromwell died. Natural causes. He was succeeded by his son Richard. The best way I can describe Richard is that he wasn't up for it. He did lack a power base. He did lack a killer instinct. But after 8 months, he resigned as Lord Protector. That left England with a complete power vacuum. Parliament struggled for a while to try and work out what to do, and eventually they realised that what they needed was a king. So in 1660, the English Parliament asked Charles II to accept the throne of England, bearing in mind he'd already been recognised as King Charles II of Scotland. Charles II accepted the throne of England, returned from the continent in what was known as the Restoration. One of the acts of that new regime was to conduct a type of revenge on Cromwell, bearing in mind that it was Charles II's father who'd been executed by Cromwell and his colleagues. So they disinterred Cromwell's body, beheaded it, and as was the custom at the time, put the head on a spike for all to see, even though he'd been dead for 2 years.
The head on the spike remained for the entire reign of the new king.
So Charles II was king until 1685. Always wanted people to remember that he and his family had their revenge on Cromwell in the end. Cromwell these days is remembered as someone who, A, was involved in the killing of a king, and B, who banned everything during his time as Lord Protector. Officially, he was ruling England for 4 years and 9 months, so not a lengthy time. Prior to that, of course, he'd had his influence as being a senior general in the parliamentary army. But we remember Cromwell as, I guess, a short-lived experiment. Could England and its parliament rule a country without a figurehead? And they came to the answer no. They came to that answer on more than one occasion. Firstly, by deciding to offer the throne to Cromwell. And as we've heard, he rejected it, but accepted the trappings. And then after the failure of his son to carry on as Lord Protector, again they turned to the monarchy model, which led to the Restoration in 1660. By the end of the 17th century, Parliament had determined how it wanted to rule England, and that was with a constitutional monarch and with a Protestant constitutional monarch. So it was Charles II's brother, another James, confusingly, who took the throne in 1685, was openly Catholic, and as soon as he had a male heir, James and his son, confusingly another James, were sent into exile to ensure that a Protestant could remain on the throne. So the break with Rome that Henry had initiated in the 16th century was locked in by the Glorious Revolution in 1688-89. How significant the figure of Cromwell is today in terms of England? Probably not as much. In terms of Ireland, immensely, because the Irish still haven't forgiven him for the massacres that happened during that invasion before Cromwell became Lord Protector.
All right, well, we have to decide a winner. Now there's three of us. We're going to decide a winner in the battle between Henry VIII and Oliver Cromwell. And luckily there's three of us, which means that we have a tiebreaker, which might come in handy.
Yes, and while in some cases our decisions have been pretty clear-cut, in a couple of cases it's actually provoked some discussion, and at some stage Scott and I know that we're going to need a tiebreaker. I don't think we're going to need one on this occasion.
Oh,
as nasty as Cromwell was in Ireland, I think the dramatic measures that Henry took with the dissolution of the monasteries and the forms of torture and execution which we heard about, in terms of biggest, baddest, meanest, I think Henry VIII is bigger, badder, meaner than Cromwell, even though Cromwell banned Christmas.
That's the thing.
I mean, that's a pretty big selling point.
I'm not certain I agree. I mean, I don't know if I disagree, but Henry certainly was more obsessed with his own authority. But the Irish thing, you can't kill 40% of the population and not be the biggest, baddest, meanest.
It's a massive bar, isn't it?
Oh, look, I acknowledge that.
I think that it's a huge, awful thing that he did, amongst other things. I would say, in terms of the most dictatorial act, it's pretty high up there, even though, Uncle Ian, you've mentioned that that was kind of before he was dictator.
The other element of looking at dictators, in, we've also spoken about significance. Henry set up a new church.
And the British Navy.
And the British Navy.
The flow-on effect from Henry's reign they're so vast and they're so entrenched in modern day society.
And in terms of greatest dictatorial act, we're still looking to find the greatest dictatorial act of all time. We have a carryover champion, which is Saddam Hussein. Last week, Francois Duvalier got closed when he decided to have all black dogs executed, but Saddam's still winning. Creating your own church so that you can get remarried is a pretty crazy dictatorial act.
It's pretty big.
It's massive. That church is still in place today. Certainly Henry had more time in which to show us his qualifications. However, I think in terms of significance, I think Henry VIII stays in the competition.
Okay, this is the difference between the two. Succession. The theme of Henry's rule was succession.
He was obsessed.
Whereas Cromwell, not obsessed. And what happens? He kicks out the monarchy, turns England into a commonwealth without a king, and yet he cannot secure succession. His son's useless, and he abdicates 8 months in because he's not up for it, as you say. Whereas Henry, he produces three possible heirs.
All of whom end up on the throne.
All of whom end up on the throne, and Elizabeth, at least, has the force of will and the health to continue Henry's legacy. So Henry, he's got the eyes on the prize. It's all about the succession.
Perhaps Cromwell should have married a few more times.
Well, yes, that possibly would have been the clincher. So I think that's pretty dictatorial, you're right, to be worried about what happens next and to be prepared to go to some extreme lengths in order
secure
to
that
secure
that legacy.
Exactly.
Mm. All right, so Henry has defeated Oliver Cromwell and remains in the running to be named history's biggest dictator. Sorry, Oliver, you've been eliminated from the tournament. Thank you very much to Stephanie for our guest appearance.
Thank you again, Scott and Uncle Ian, for having me. It's great to be
here. Steph, it's been a pleasure.
Next time we're going to Southeast Asia. Our next matchup is Ho Chi Minh versus Pol Pot. And so I'm very excited about this one. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while. There'll be a lot of death, I expect. Quick announcements. Last week we covered Fidel Castro and Francois Duvalier. I was told that there was a technical difficulty that has now been corrected. So if anyone has listened to that and could not hear the final result and has now been corrected, we have an email address where you can suggest dictators. The draw is not yet finalized, which means that you can submit your suggestions. The email address is libertydiespodcast@gmail.com. We also have a Twitter account where we're posting announcements and dictator-related propaganda. It's probably the right
fun
word.
Fact.
The Twitter account is @libertydiespod. Looking forward to next time. Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you, Uncle Ian.
Thank you, Scott.